This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tite. Thank you so much for being with us today. This month, WUWM and Milwaukee Public Television began a six-month collaboration examining the issue of incarceration among black men in Wisconsin. The state has the highest rate in the country, and Milwaukee County's numbers are even higher. More than half of African-American men in their 30s have spent time behind bars. But racial disparities exist nationally as well, and the national data offers some context for the situation in Wisconsin. The Washington, D.C.-based group The Sentencing Project tracks incarceration statistics and makes policy recommendations aimed at reducing incarceration levels nationwide. Mark Maurer is the group's executive director, and he joins us this morning by phone. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Can you give us a national snapshot of the issue, especially of race and incarceration?
Well, you know, as we've seen the prison explosion of the last four decades, we now have about seven times as many people in our prison system as we did in the early 1970s. We've also seen enormous racial disparities in the use of incarceration. African Americans are incarcerated roughly six to seven times the rate of white Americans, Latinos about two and a half times the rate of white Americans. And you know, this comes at a point where U.S. incarceration rates are actually in the world lead of how we imprison our people. So we're both the most incarcerating nation. And then if we look at racial ethnic minorities, those figures are dramatically higher even than the national averages.
Is it possible to point to crimes and say this is a particular case where a white person would not be sentenced or would be sentenced at a lower rate than a person of color?
Well, it's a complicated story, and I think it's not just one where we can look at a certain point in the justice system, say, on the day of sentencing. There are many studies that look at, say, a white burglar and a black burglar on the day of sentencing, and, you know, do they get the same sentence in prison or in the community? And some studies say yes, and some studies say no, there's a little difference or so. But I think what we do know is that there's very much a cumulative effect of how cases are processed in the justice system. So decisions made by law enforcement on who to arrest, by prosecutors, what kind of charges, by the quality of your defense attorney, judicial decisions, each decision-making point may have an impact on the outcome of those cases. So I think we need to look at the sort of totality of decision-making to try to get a feel for how that plays out.
What got us to this point? The data shows, as you point out, that imprisonment rates and racial disparities also did not always look like this.
Right. Well, I think we've seen, you know, this explosion in incarceration. And just to be clear, you know, most people in prison have committed crimes and they've been convicted of that. Occasionally there's some innocent people, but most of the people have been convicted of violating the law. I think it's two parts in some ways. One is that, you know, public safety is traditionally a function of a variety of institutions. So it's family upbringing, it's community supports, it's education, it's access to opportunity, and it's also criminal justice initiatives. And what's happened in recent decades is that I think we've gotten very much out of balance, that we've come to rely very heavily on the criminal justice system as our primary response to disorder, misbehavior, particularly in low-income communities of color, and in many respects that set up a vicious cycle. As we pour more resources into the back end of the system, there's consequently less available up front for prevention, interventions, treatment initiatives that might head off the cycle of crime in the first place. We also have policies like, you know, tough-on-crime sentencing, the war on drugs, which have really exacerbated these figures and in many cases contributed to the racial disparities we're seeing as well.
But you would contend that just blaming, say, the Rockefeller drug laws or the three strikes and you're out kinds of policies maybe oversimplifies the problem?
Well, yes, I do. I think it's a broad problem. You know, many of the policies adopted in the last couple of decades and many of them growing out of the war on drugs have really made things considerably worse. California's three strikes and you're out policy, for example, just a couple of cases from there went to the Supreme Court. One man, his third strike was stealing three golf clubs from a sporting goods store. Another man's third strike was stealing $153 of videotapes. The golf club thief was sentenced to 25 to life. The videotape thief, 50 to life. And these were sentences that were upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court, which did not find that they represented cruel and unusual punishment. So clearly we shouldn't condone people stealing golf clubs and videotapes. You know, whether this is a wise, let alone compassionate policy is a very different question.
What would you contend is the right role for prison to play in general in terms of the people who commit crimes, the victims of crime in society at large?
Well, I think what's often forgotten in some of the discussion is that 95% of the people we send to prison are coming home someday. Some will come home in a year, some in 20 years. But, you know, if all we care about is vengeance and punishment, we're selling ourselves short, I think. You know, it's in everyone's interest that when people come home from prison, they be better equipped, better prepared to make it legitimately in the community than before they were sent there. And, you know, in many respects, we've done just the opposite of what's needed in recent decades. As we've piled up the numbers in prison, the relatively limited programming that's always been available in prison in many ways is getting stretched even further. So opportunities for education, vocational training, substance abuse, counseling, and treatment are very modest in general, given the scale of the problem. So we take people from disadvantaged communities with many factors that at least contribute to their becoming involved in crime. If we don't address them very constructively, then all we've done is incapacitate people at a huge expense with little positive impact on their doing better once they get out of prison.
As you say, it doesn't seem like there is one single point of failure along the way, but where do you see enforcement fitting in this equation?
Well, I think, you know, police, you know, as do other actors in the justice system, you know, have a great deal of discretion available to them, and there's nothing wrong with that. Decisions need to be made all the time, but how that discretion is employed, we see this, you know, most clearly in the war on drugs, which, you know, has ramped up dramatically since the mid-1980s with pretty strong racially disparate outcomes. Essentially, we have really a two-tiered war on drugs. When parents in middle-income communities discover their teenage son or daughter has a drug problem, they don't call up the police and demand that their kid be arrested. They try to get their child into the best treatment program they can find. When similar problems come up in low-income communities, those same resources are not available, and so it's much more likely to become a criminal justice problem. And so we throw police and prosecutors in prison cells at the problem there. So we have some very similar problems, but in many cases, we approach in very different ways, depending on really family and community resources available to try to address that issue.
You recently co-authored an op-ed in the Washington Times about this issue, and you pointed to the example of a man who essentially facilitated a drug deal and got a disproportionately stiff sentence compared to the other people that were involved. How is that particular example emblematic of what you see as wrong with the system?
Well, the case of Clarence Aaron was a football player at Southern University in the early 1990s. His crime involved, he introduced one of his friends at school to an old high school friend who was a cocaine dealer, and it led to the sale of about 20 pounds of cocaine, a substantial amount. Clarence Aaron, the sort of go-between, didn't buy or sell or supply any of the drugs, but he refused to testify against the other people, refused to take the plea deal he'd been offered, and he ended up getting the most extreme penalty. He was sentenced to 3 life terms without parole. This was his first conviction. So he's been serving that sentence now for more than 20 years. This is an outgrowth of the federal mandatory penalties established for drug offenses back in the 1980s, you know, applying very harsh penalties based on the quantity of drugs and that do not permit the judge to have any discretion into taking account his relative role in the drug trade, changes in his behavior, orientation while he's in prison and the like. And the only way that Clarence Aaron can ever get out would be if he gets a commutation from the president. And commutations are extremely difficult to get at the moment, certainly. And so even though he's done all the right things one could expect in prison, he's still looking at spending the rest of his life behind bars for that one drug transaction.
Speaking of the president, the attorney general is basically working with states around the country to look at the issue of mandatory minimums. Do you think that effort is starting to tackle the right questions?
I think there's no question we're starting to see a change in the political climate on these issues. Attorney General Holder this summer delivered a high-profile speech in which he said there are now too many people in too many prisons for far too long. Pretty remarkable words coming from the Attorney General. And he and many other leaders of both parties have been very critical of the excessive use of mandatory penalties and how they've really distorted our sentencing policies and led to incarceration. Most notably, we're seeing now in Congress, which is, you know, quite well known for not exactly being very bipartisan these days, in the Senate, the Judiciary Committee is about to hear two bills that would reform mandatory sentencing, scale back the severity of those penalties. And what's most intriguing is the sponsorship of those bills.
Where do you think this falls as a campaign issue in the midterm elections?
Well, I don't think that criminal justice reform will necessarily be a high priority for most politicians, but probably more importantly, neither will tough on crime initiatives be a high priority. You know, we had a period in the 80s and 90s, the height of the war on drugs, where many political people, ranging from presidential candidates on down, were campaigning on how tough they could be on crime and drugs. That era is pretty much over now. There's been a real shift in the climate. More and more political leaders are now recognizing we need a more balanced approach. We need to deal with drug issues that in ways that involve prevention, treatment. So I think that the absence of any of that rhetoric on the campaign trail should continue to embolden people like we see in the Senate who feel a certain comfort level in going ahead with mandatory sentencing reform with less fear that they may be attacked for being soft on crime as they would have felt previously.
Are there examples that you see of states that are starting to reverse engineer the system with some success?
Well, we've seen some significant shifts in recent years. In the last 3 years, the prison population nationally has actually declined modestly. It's just a very small shift, but compared to the preceding four decades, it's significant. And in three states, New York, New Jersey, California, there's been actually a 20% decline in their prison population over the last decade. In New York and New Jersey in particular, this has been a fairly conscious shift involving changes in policy. So New York scaling back the Rockefeller drug laws, harsh mandatory sentencing, also providing incentives for sentence reductions by participating in programs in prison. In New Jersey, rather than sending everyone back to prison who might have committed an infraction while on parole supervision, there's now more scrutiny of them, more use of halfway houses as a way to deal with the behavior that's short of imposing new prison terms. So some of this is sort of day-to-day shifts by practitioners who are looking at prison as a very expensive resource, essentially saying, how can we reduce the sort of excessive use of incarceration? How do we reserve it for cases in which protecting the public is necessary, but we shouldn't be doing it just because we're mad at these people who broke the laws. We should be figuring out, you know, what ways we can change their behavior while also supervising them appropriately in the community.
Mark Maurer, thanks so much for helping us put this conversation in a national context.
And thanks for having me, too.
Mark Maurer is executive director of the Sentencing Project based in Washington, D.C. You can find links to the group's national data on incarceration rates, plus more from our Project Milwaukee series, Black Men in Prison, at WUWM.com. We'll take a quick break and in just a moment get some insight into the sometimes nebulous and confusing world of young professional organizations in Milwaukee. What are they trying to accomplish? This is Lake Effect from WUWM.